So welcome to another edition of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, and the co-host this week is Dorian Benkoil of Teaming Media, who is our sales and marketing manager at Media Shift, and is filling in for Rafat. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Yeah, I guess Rafat is... He stopped his kind of around the world travels, but I guess he needed to go on one more trip to Uzbekistan.
Yeah, Rafat Ali is a world traveler. He's been all over the place, and you know, I don't even know why he's in Uzbekistan, but he said it was not business.
Right. Yeah, he is. He's quite the traveler. So I've not been in that part of the world. Do you know a lot about Uzbekistan?
I have not been in the stands at all. I had a number of, when I was a foreign correspondent at the Associated Press, I had a number of friends who were based in Afghanistan and traveled around Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, all, you know, what they jokingly called the stands. And one of them actually, unfortunately, was killed in a helicopter crash. But no, I've never been. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, she was riding with some Afghan military officials and the helicopter crashed into a mountain. So, Wow. Yeah, really, you know, when you're doing foreign news, you really get confronted with the real dangers very often.
Well, hopefully Rafat will keep it safe. And I guess the fact that he's not making a business trip might be better for him.
Yeah, I can't wait to come back and hear what the tourist sites in Uzbekistan are.
Yeah, we'll get the full report from him. First thing we'll talk about is Apple and its subscription plan, and how it kind of launched a subscription plan early in February, was going to take 30% from publishers and had a lot of restrictions that upset people. And now they've kind of backtracked and are being a little bit more flexible on those terms. Meanwhile, the Financial Times is kind of going around Apple. So that'll be our first topic. And then next we'll have a special guest, Matthew Heineman from George Washington University, who just helped put together a study about local news online and the dearth of traffic for a lot of these kind of local news sites that have been popping up. And people have been talking about whether they're hyper-local news sites or nonprofit news sites. They've all had trouble gaining traction, at least according to his research. And then finally, we'll talk about how the New York Times and Wired Magazine have kind of backtracked on their prices for digital subscriptions and iPad apps. So first, let's talk about Apple. They've kind of, you know, started out basically upsetting a lot of people with the very kind of strict rules around app pricing. If you want to have an app as a publisher for the iPad or for smartphones, you have to basically give Apple 30%. You had to have very strict pricing that was consistent everywhere. You couldn't basically charge a little bit more to get your 30% back. And you had to basically, they have the data for the customers that you have. I mean, they keep the information as far as who's subscribing, who's not. And now they're kind of backtracking and saying, okay, we're going to be a little bit more flexible in price. You can try to sign up subscribers on your own sites. What do you think is going on with Apple? I mean, what did you think? I guess, first of all, what did you think about their original plan, and what do you think about these moves now?
Well, we're, of course, talking primarily about the iPad, because I think, you know, that's been seen in the publishing industry and the media industry, content creation and distribution industry is the new device that's going to be something of a savior. People, in fact, on iPads and other tablets do consume more media than they've tended to on the smaller devices like a smartphone. So you know, we're talking primarily about the iPad. And I think Apple originally was doing sort of what Apple always tends to do, which is say, we're going to create this universe, but you're going to have to play by our rules because we're going to control it. And, you know, we're going to do both carrot and stick. We're going to create this incentive to have you sell your content through the iTunes store. It's a beautiful interface and people will be able to use it and purchase easily and you'll just collect the revenue and not have any hassles. But we're also going to have the stick of you can't link out and we're going to keep the data and, you know, a bunch of other restrictions. And so, they've lessened the restrictions a bit, but there are still issues for publishers. We'll see. I mean, I think Apple's listening to the market and, you know, loosening up a little, and we'll see if they have to loosen up a little more.
Yeah. And what about this move by Financial Times? We had a story, Roland Legrand had a story in MediaShift this week talking about his own publication in Belgium and how they're considering, you know, just optimizing kind of what they're calling a web app, or just, you know, through the browser, you basically make a site that is optimized for the iPad, for a tablet, without having to have an app at all. Just let people go directly to your web app or go to your web browser and look at things, and it just goes around any kind of payment to Apple. I mean, that seems like something that a lot of publishers must be considering right now.
Yeah, I mean, I know for a fact that they are, because I've been working with a company called TreeSaver, which does an HTML5 scheme for app-like solutions for all screens, including tablets. And, you know, TreeSaver's been talking to a lot of publishers who are considering an HTML5 solution because, you know, there's a lot of benefits. I mean, the technology isn't quite there yet. So
you're talking about, so HTML5 is basically, this is kind of like a different version of Flash, or a way to kind of create more of a multimedia experience on a tablet.
Well, it's actually not Flash. It's a website. You know, HTML5 is the most recent version of HTML, which is the language upon which websites are built that browsers can recognize. So any browser, you know, standard browser compliant device, which means tablet devices, most smartphones, and computers, most browsers, can see a website, which is, so something done in HTML5 is a website. And the beauty of HTML5 is compared to previous versions of HTML is it allows a lot of the nifty functionality that we get from apps right in the HTML, so you don't have to have a plugin or some special JavaScript or other stuff that makes certain machines choke. It's right in the HTML, so you can do things like, you know, little whiz-bang graphics and flipping pictures, and you can even render the video right in HTML5. You don't have to have it encapsulated in some other format. So a lot of publishers like this, and the Financial Times, you know, said, hey, we'd rather keep 100% of the revenue, because if people, so people subscribe to the FT, we'll let them have this app-like function on their tablets through this one-button click, and they don't have to go through the iTunes store. They can just get it, and we can still do fulfillment just like we do on our website. And they get to use their web analytics and keep the data, so they know not only how many subscribers they have, but what pages they view and how many unique visitors and all those things that are lifeblood for a publisher. And they get to set the rules.
Yeah, I'm curious also, like, we had a big announcement from Apple on iOS and how they're updating that and iCloud and things like that. But the one thing that they didn't talk about at all is the iAd, that advertising platform they've been touting, you know, a year ago. And now it just seems like, you know, at first we had all this news about, oh, you know, advertisers are spending tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars on these iAd, on the iAd platform. And now it almost seems like it's disappeared and we don't hear about it at all.
Yeah, I'm guessing that Apple didn't do tremendously well selling those. And that's another huge issue for publishers, right? Because
yeah,
you would love to go to a client, you know, perhaps a consumer packaged goods company, and say, hey, I'm going to put together this beautiful app, and it's so beautiful that I can put your beautiful ads in there too, not to mention the fact that people are scrolling through the pages and spending long session time, so they'll see a lot of your beautiful ads. But guess what? Maybe because it's an app in the Apple Store on the iOS platform, I'm not allowed to place the ads using my technology, but I don't want to go through the iAd technology because that is complicated and it might cause revenue problems. So, you know, that's another reason for people to go outside of the whole Apple universe with their publishing and content.
Yeah, it seems like a real overreach on Apple's part. You know, if the iPad was not so dominant as a tablet and wasn't, you know, had such a huge market share, where they feel like, hey, we can dictate the terms, You'd think they'd be a lot more forthcoming to publishers and saying, hey, we want to be the place for people to get their subscriptions to magazines, newspapers, whatever it is, and let's just make this a really simple, friction-free type of thing so that publishers can just get on it and people can get all the content they want and it's really easy and simple. And for the user, they're not going to see all this stuff in the background. But it just seems like when it comes to I think maybe just the fact that they were so dominant in tablets made them feel like they could kind of get away with anything.
Well, let's look at it realistically, though. Yes, today they're dominant in tablets, right? 90%+ of the market, 94, 95, something like that. But that's still a fraction of a fraction of an audience that a publisher would want to reach, because even though they're the dominant tablet, not the majority of people don't have tablets.
Right.
And the predictions are that as all these other Android tablets and BlackBerry tablets and other things are coming out, they're going to start taking market share from Apple. So if Apple has 95% today, maybe next year they have 70%. Now, are you going to ignore 30% of your tablet audience? Not to mention the 80 or 90% of your user base community that isn't even on a tablet device. So
Right.
how much effort as a publisher do you want to put in to developing this expensive app for one platform that's a fraction of a fraction of your audience and a diminishing share?
So Matt Hyman is assistant professor in the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University. His work focuses on political communication with a concentration on internet politics. His book, The Myth of Digital Democracy, was published in 2009 by Princeton University Press and looks at the internet's impact on American politics. Parts of the book present evidence that the internet has indeed mobilized previously inactive citizens and changed the way that campaigns and interest groups recruit, communicate, and raise funds. And now recently, Matt, you've had this study that I guess was with the FCC around local news. Tell us a little bit about the findings in that study.
Well, the exciting thing about the study, from my perspective, was that it actually provided comprehensive data on local news, which we really haven't had before. Unfortunately, the findings that came out of this commission study for the FCC were a bit grimmer than I had hoped. Particularly, the big takeaway was just that there was a lot less local news traffic than I think most people had assumed. In a typical market, the local news traffic averaged about a half of a percent of all page views or all time spent online. There were a lot fewer outlets providing local news than I think many of us expected, with a typical market having about 9 or 10 local news outlets on the web. And perhaps most surprisingly, was just how few internet-only or web-native news organizations there were that reached that reached the traffic threshold needed to show up in the study. Of the roughly 1,100 news sites that local news sites the study found, only 17 were actually online-only web-native news outlets.
And so tell us a little bit about how you're defining those news outlets, because I think about I'm in San Francisco, and I think about there are so many local outlets
Right.
online. I mean, there's blogs, there's things like SF Appeal, there's Bay Citizen, but there's also things like, if I think about where I get the news in my neighborhood, it might be just a private email list of parents, or it might be a private email list of my block or something. There are things like
Yeah.
Front Porch Forum. And I don't know whether you can capture that in Comscore, right?
Certainly, things like RSS feeds or email are not going to be captured with Comscore's data. The good news, and unfortunately, the bad news, is that the sites that actually do reach a significant number of people in the Comscore data, enough to actually measure, are very traditional sites. Overwhelmingly, they are daily newspapers and television station websites. And unfortunately, what you find in most of these markets is that the online news traffic is extremely concentrated, with only just, well, in a solid majority of these cases, two or three outlets get the large majority of local news traffic.
I was actually wondering, Professor Hyman, how this compares to traditional media, because because, you know, I understand you're saying in a democracy, ideally people would get their news from a diversity of sources, but is it any less diverse than in traditional media and perhaps more? And also, do we know what the percentage of media consumption of local news is in traditional versus the consumption of other media in traditional?
In terms of local news consumption in traditional media, we've known for a while that most of that comes actually through local television news, especially local nightly news. So that seems to be where the majority of citizens are finding out about local affairs. In terms of broader cross-media comparisons, it's certainly less concentrated than you find in print. The vast majority of local markets in this country have only one daily print newspaper, and very few of those have a direct competitor, and even fewer all the time, as we've seen papers like the Rocky Mountain News and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer are closed in the last few years. But I have to say, I expected, initially at least, to find more diversity and less concentration. This looks more like traditional media than even I was expecting.
Do you know, when you say that only 0.5% of consumption is from local sites, do you mean media consumption or news consumption?
Media consumption as a whole, in terms of minutes spent or page views. Now, it's certainly true that news in general, while not a huge portion of what people do online, fares much better than local news in particular. In a typical market, about an hour per person per month is spent viewing news sites, and that's roughly five times as much time as is spent looking at local news outlets.
Yeah, I mean, so it's not that surprising that I mean, 0.5% is certainly not very much, but it isn't surprising that a vast majority of time would be spent on other than news, right? That they're, whether it's entertainment or, you know, video gaming or chatting with grandma or whatever else. It's certainly not surprising that news would be a minority of that.
Yeah, I think that's certainly true. And I think in some ways that's really the problem for local news in particular. One thing we know about the internet is everything on the internet competes with everything else on the internet. And I think it's particularly difficult for local news to break through that.
And I'm also curious how you define local news versus, you know, let's say a blog post or an opinion. I mean, are you saying it has to be reporting or original reporting? How do you define it?
The coding guidelines focused on any source of news or information that would tend to inform citizens about local affairs, local politics, and events going on in their community. And you can imagine that you would imagine that there might be edge cases that sort of are a little bit tricky. In reality, so few of these edge cases got enough traffic, particularly in the larger study, that nobody disputes that the Dallas Morning News, for example, counts as a news and information source. And so since the sites that got this level of traffic were overwhelmingly newspapers and television sites, the definition didn't prove to be that much of an issue. It's a little bit harder because part of the reality, as part of the study design and particularly as a reality check for the larger and broader analysis, the study does look at five smaller markets. Five individual markets, trying to get a sense through web searches, particularly if there might be sources that are left out or that whether there might be smaller sources that for some reason don't show up in the ComScore data. And there you do find a significant number of blogs that talk about politics. And in fact, in all five of the markets that I looked at as part of this study, I did find at least one new internet-only web native outlet that seemed to be producing content that would be valuable for people to learn about regarding their local communities.
What about with news, let's say local news coming through places like Twitter, like a Twitter feed that has, obviously you're not going to get full reported stories, but you might have breaking news tidbits here and there. And on Facebook, I mean, I think about something like the Joplin relief effort. They set up a page on Facebook that has incredible up-to-date information about, here's where you should go for this relief effort, or here's where you should go to volunteer. And there's a lot that seems to me like that is informing and that is local information, but it's not maybe falling into the traditional way of defining news.
I think that's right. When scholars talk about this, they sometimes talk about monitorial citizenship or burglar alarm citizenship. This notion is that it might be okay for a lot of things if people only pay attention to politics when things go obviously wrong. And there's something to be said for that notion of citizenship, even if it doesn't look like what we're normally teaching in our high school civic education classes. At the same time, it's unclear over the long term what the effect will be if it really is the case that people are consuming less local news. If people, I mean, if you look at what's happening with web traffic, the decline in local news isn't just about the web, and it's just not just about substituting online sources for offline sources, particularly print sources. But to the extent that that is driving the phenomenon, what seems to be happening, and I think the data here tells this story clearly, is that individuals are substituting a local newspaper for a national online news outlet.
Well, thanks a lot. I really appreciate your time and coming on and talking with us.
All right. Well, thank you, Mark. Thank you, Dorian.
So the last thing we'll talk about is the pricing on apps and digital subscriptions and just how that's kind of shifted even just in the last few months. The New York Times came out with their paywall and their pricing for that seemed to be very high. When we first looked at that, we thought this $15 a month for access to the web and smartphone and $25 a month for iPad app and web and just these really what seemed to be pretty high prices now seem like they've come down. The Times has now made an offer of 26 weeks for $1.88 a week. It's starting to look a lot more like what you see from magazines where they're kind of heavily and newspapers too, where they're kind of heavily discounting their print. Although, that's kind of gone in the opposite direction for newspapers. Now it looks like the New York Times is kind of backtracking and making a much cheaper offer for long-term web subscription. And now Wired magazine has also, they were charging pretty much the cover price of a magazine to get an iPad app of Wired. Now they're basically saying for $12.99 a year, what you pay for print, you're going to also get the iPad app thrown in for free. Now, these are real big changes from what they used to be. Is that just, I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is just a function of demand, lack of demand, that people really were excited about the iPad app and these digital subscriptions, and then, it kind of fades away after a few months and they need to do something to keep it going?
Yeah, well, the beauty of digital is that you can change everything on the fly, and part of the downside of digital is that you can change. But it does allow experimentation, and I think, what we're seeing here is just sort of classic price point experimentation. Okay, we'll try this point, see what happens. Okay, then we'll do some, run our charts and graphs and do a little microeconomic analysis. And well, that didn't, let's see what happens when we do this price point. Let's try this kind of bundle and that kind of bundle. I mean, the Wall Street Journal, Gordon Krovitz, the publisher of the Wall Street Journal, told me that they did that with bundling and unbundling and changing pricing on print and web subscriptions for a number of years, and he even brought in some PhD statisticians from the Wharton School to help him out and, run their analyses. And so I'm guessing that that's the same thing going on with these other organizations. They're saying, all right, we've got this new platform, the iPad, and let's try these different pricings and bundles and see what happens. And I wouldn't be surprised if what you said is true, that they discovered, well, this really high price point doesn't work, so let's try a lower price point.
I mean, what do you think about, I mean, Henry Blodgett at Business Insider, he's going to come out and say, oh, the New York Times paywall is working. It's a huge success because, you know, they signed up 100,000 digital subscribers. They're now saying that their print subscriptions are actually going up, but not saying exactly how many. It seems like it's too early to just come out and say it's a success, it's a failure within a few months. I mean, they obviously can tinker around with their prices, what content you can see, the number of stories you can see. Can you see more through Twitter? Can you see more through social media, Google search? There's so much they can play around with if they really are, you know, employing. I don't know if they're getting, you know, Wharton type people looking at this stuff, but you could really play around with it in so many different ways. It's hard to really give a, you know, a complete, this is a failure, this is a success this soon, right?
Yeah, of course. You know, because as we said in a previous segment, you know, only a fraction of the universe even has these devices yet. You're going to see more and more of them coming online. So this is a time of experimentation, and you can say success or failure yet. And Blodgett has a point. I mean, actually, a point that I made a few weeks ago in a radio interview on public radio, and I said, you know, don't look at digital as its own universe. If the Times is able to shore up its print subscription base, you know, either decrease the level of decline or actually get some new print subscribers because of this scheme, because they offer the digital if you also buy the print, then they'll be happy with that because they still make the lion's share of their revenue from print. And so, you know, if this helps the print, then that's all well and good. It's not just about the digital universe, and it's not just about page views or any of that.
Yeah, but it does seem a little bit backward to be propping up your kind of print or your legacy media in a way. I mean, yes, it's true they are making more in advertising that they sell in print today, but you know, if advertisers are going to get smart and start going to more digital outlays, then you know that doesn't seem like that's going to last forever. And you know, just printing everything, the cost of that, distributing it, I mean, those costs are just going up, they're not going down. And it just seems a little bit backward to try to kind of prop up or continue a medium that's going to, you know, slowly go away.
Yeah, I know. It does seem like a short-term strategy. I suppose that if I were the New York Times, my answer to that would be, well, at the same time that we're doing that, we're also experimenting and building out the digital platform so that as more people do move to digital, we'll be in position to capture that as well. And when advertisers want to go into digital, we'll be in position to offer the advertisers the exposures there and sell subscriptions there and sell single issues there. So that, you know, like I said, if I were the New York Times, that would be my answer, that I'm not just helping my print subscription base, I'm also learning about digital and how to do it right and charge for it correctly and all that stuff.
It sounds like you do a good job as the spokesman for the New York Times or
know,
their paywall.
I just think it's easy to say that they're all wrong and they're doing this thing and they're stupid and you know paywalls are idiotic, and I think it's important to take a more measured approach and say, you know, is there a business rationale for this, and how can we look at this rationally, right? So it may not succeed, you know, but to, as you know, as you said, we can't say it's a success yet. We also can't say it's a failure yet. You know, we have to
Right.
give them credit for trying and maybe doing things in a way that could give them information over time and lead to significant gains over time.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer of PBS Media Shift. I want to thank our co-host Dorian Benkoil, as well as our guest Matthew Heineman from George Washington University. Thanks to PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to stay up with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister blog Idea Lab at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.